Good evening, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of The Bog right here on DLive.tv/Dave Martell live every single Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern. Tonight we have an excellent guest, but before we get started, I got a couple of plugs for everybody. The Episys magazine, number 3, is out. Everybody saw all the promo stuff, saw the commercial. This thing is selling like hotcakes, and I am so proud to be a part of this publication. Man, so many of us put our hearts and souls into this, and man, I appreciate and you know, so much love going out to everybody that picked up a copy. This was a big project, but Episys magazine available on Amazon. I'll have a link in the description. Also, this show is brought to you by our boy, the Iron Age Jyotish. Everybody saw the episode of Vedic Astrology a few weeks ago with our boy Neil John, and me and him struck up a deal, and now he is sponsoring The Bog. So make sure to go over to facebook.com/Iron Age Jyotish and check it out, man. Like, you guys know me. I am not a big fan of new agey weird stuff, horoscopes. I've never been into that stuff. Neil blew me away with the Vedic astrology. So I implore you, go check him out. Facebook.com/Iron Age Jyotish. And before we get started, our boy Tristan from Arya Kasha, he has COVID. So unfortunately, he's not joining us tonight. So everybody send out your prayers and your blessings. And hopefully Tristan heals up very soon and comes back to the Bog with that big brain of his. Much love, many blessings to him and his entire family, man. Our hearts are with you. We love you, Tristan. We'll see you back soon. But without further ado, my guest tonight is somebody that I am a huge fan of, Sridharma Pravartakacharya from the International Sanatana Dharma Foundation, Dharma Nation, and Dharma Central. He is a teacher. He's written multiple books, including Dharma Manifesto and Radical Universalism. Without further ado, Acharya, I am humbled and honored to have you on the Bog. Namaste.
Namaste. David, it's absolutely my pleasure. Again, thank you very much for inviting me, for having me on. I've seen several of your previous shows, and as we were chatting a little bit before the show, and as I said then, you are very professional in everything that you do with your shows, with all of your interviews. So again, it is truly my honor to be on. Thank you for inviting me.
Absolutely. My pleasure. So let's get right into it. I have so many questions for you, and we're going to try to get as much in as we can. So let's get started here. This is what I wanted to initially ask you. You are probably the first, I guess you could say, clergyman or somebody from a traditional spirituality that has come and shown interest in Asatru. Why? Obviously the Catholic priests don't come talk to us. I've never heard of the Buddhists come talk to us. You're the first guy to come show interest and see potential in us. And we're a little bit rough around the edges. We have a lot of way to go. But in your opinion, what do you see in Asatru, and what drove you to your interest in our community?
Sure. Well, first of all, as far as being rough around the edges, Asatru people tend to be rough around the edges in all the right ways, I think, at least many of them. There's very much a very good, what in Sanskrit we would say, Kshatriya spirit, a very good warrior spirit that is there among followers of Asatru, which is something that I very much appreciate. But to answer your question in full, for myself, you know, I've been both practicing and studying the Vedic tradition, what is called Sanatana Dharma, for many, many, many decades. At this point, roughly 46 years or so, I've been on this path since I was about 10. And I have studied it extremely deeply, both personally, but academically as well, eventually earning a PhD from University of Wisconsin-Madison. But the thing that attracted me very specifically to Vedic culture was indeed the fact that I, in addition to being interested in Vedic culture itself per se, I also saw the connections between really most, if not all, of, let's say, the pre-Abrahamic spiritual traditions. And especially when it came to looking at the similarities between Asatru and Vedic culture, I immediately, many decades ago, recognized that they were sister religions. And very much, not cousins, not friends, not distant relatives. They are sister religions. Mm-hmm. The similarities between the two are truly astounding and mind-boggling. I discussed just a little bit of this in several of my books, including The Dharma Manifesto and Sanatana Dharma, The Eternal Natural Way. In several of the videos on the Dharma Nation channel on YouTube, I also discuss many of the similarities. Indeed, maybe a month ago or so, roughly, we in fact put out a video in which I was interviewed specifically on Asatru and what are the connections between this faith versus Sanatana Dharma. And again, for anyone who has studied the two religions, you see that, again, the similarities are truly astounding. The only real difference being, let's say the only significant difference being that, of course, as we know, as was the case with all of the pre-Christian European religions, of course, these religions, these indigenous religions of Europe, were under attack for so long, for almost 2,000 years, not quite, about 1,700 years, more or less, by the Abrahamic forces, by Christian missionaries, by Christian priests, etc. And as a result, of course, much of the original knowledge and culture and practices and lineages, spiritual lineages, sadly have been lost, they've been tampered with, etc. And of course, it depends on where you look in Europe. Among the Greco-Roman pagans, for example, for lack of a better term, we have a lot of information that is still there. There is a lot of literature for the Slavic, let's say, and Norse versions of pre-Christian European religion. We have a little bit less. And then when it comes to the Celtic religion, there's very little information that is extant. So the only real major difference is that, again, with the pre-Christian European religions, they have been under attack and under assault for almost 2,000 years. As a result, much has been lost. Whereas with the Vedic tradition, while we also were under attack, everything has been retained. And I mean everything, from the literature to the sadhana, what are called sadhana, that is the actual spiritual practices for self-enfoldment, self-development spiritually, but also even the lineages of teacher and disciple, stretching back quite literally to the beginning of time. It is all intact in Vedic spirituality. So this really is the only main difference between Asatru versus Vedic spirituality. And of course, as I'm sure you and many, many people now know, individuals who are serious followers of Asatru, many leaders, especially in recent decades of Asatru, have indeed been turning to individuals like myself, individuals who are more steeped in, let's say, the Vedic tradition, mm-hmm. or just a little bit of help, a little bit of help in filling in the blanks, in filling in all of those areas where, again, the original knowledge of Nordic spirituality has been lost. And it is indeed with the recognition that the two traditions are so similar in every way, philosophically, culturally, as far as ethos and ethics, as far as even politics, as far as practices, et cetera, as far as the gods and goddesses who are invoked. The two are so similar to the point where, again, the only differences between them are mostly just linguistic and cultural. So for myself, having recognized this, it's an interesting phenomena that occurred, and I won't go much deeper into this because I know you have many other questions, but it's an interesting thing that happened to me very specifically. Again, myself having known about Asatru for decades, in 2013, I put out a book, and it was called The Dharma Manifesto. Mm-hmm. And it was very specifically a political book. It was a political manifesto with the idea of how to take natural law, how to take Dharma, and instantiate it politically. And interestingly, when I wrote this book, the audience that I had in mind were actually followers of Vedic spirituality who didn't understand politics and were being kind of led astray into, let's say, liberalism and left-wing ideologies, etc. Interestingly, what happened was when this book came out in 2013, the people who actually read and embraced and just heralded this book, just praised it, were Asatru people. And that was a very happy surprise to me, but it was a surprise because, again, that was not the audience I had in mind. Yet the book, interestingly, has been read by probably at this point thousands of followers of Asatru who have embraced the book. So it's been a very interesting thing. Now, in 2020, since the book has come out, I find that I apparently have a massive audience among Asatru people in addition to Vedic people. People who come and watch the videos, for example, on the Dharma Nation channel, people who come to our website, dharmacentral.com, people who contact us, I would say half of them are followers of Asatru. And again, the reason why is they themselves see the connections and the fact that Vedic spirituality, Sanatana Dharma, and Asatru are pretty much the same. Again, just different language, culturally different, but spiritually the same.
Yeah, absolutely. I would, you mentioned about your videos. I ferociously watch almost all of your videos. I've seen, you know, especially your one, you probably hear this a lot, but your one on Lord of the Rings. That's the one that I recommend first when folks ask me about it. I absolutely love that because me, myself, I am diehard Tolkien fan. A quick story for everybody. My grandfather on my mom's side came from Italy. He was from Calabria, and he didn't really speak English. And the first book that he learned in English was The Hobbit. So he read that to me when I was a little kid, and ever since then, I've been obsessed with Tolkien. So that's just been a big part of my life. So when you introduced a lot of these spiritual ideas with describing this movie and the books, it was really special for me because there's so many things. And you came out and said it, and you said you believe that both the movie and the book were guided by a divine hand. And I agree with that wholeheartedly. So I'm going to ask you something a little bit more practical. Because we are sister religions, we do have so much in common, especially with this. There's a lot of interest in Indo-European research, comparative research. So the commonalities are really coming to the surface, and it's becoming more commonplace. There's a lot of folks that ask me, they say, can I go to a Dharmic temple? They say, can I go to a Sanatana Dharma temple? And can I practice there, being Asatru? So this is my question for you. Can folks that follow Asatru go to a Dharmic temple? And if so, what customs or traditions should we do so we can be respectful while we worship?
Sure, that's a very good question, actually. In fact, it's interesting. No one's actually ever asked me that. So it's a very original, very good question. Let me just say this, first of all, as a little bit of background. First of all, interestingly, one thing that I'm known for is attacking what philosophically I have called radical universalism. And that is the idea of taking, let's say, disperse religions that are literally at odds with each other and trying to merge them. We know that this is one of the hallmarks of 20th century fraudulent spirituality. This is what New Age people do, where they say, oh, yes, I am a Muslim, Hindu, Buddhist, Christian, atheist. All sorts of nonsense like this that contain inherent contradictions, etc. So on the one hand, yes, we don't believe in merging, again, disparate elements. But once again, when it comes to Asatru versus Vedic spirituality, as I keep mentioning, we are sister religions. So as a result, for example, you'll notice that even though I'm a Vedic spiritual leader and teacher, I am wearing a Mjolnir. I'm wearing a Thor's hammer. There's a vast difference between this sort of New Age radical universalism on the one hand, saying, oh, it doesn't matter what you believe, etc., versus recognizing, again, sister religions, where in actuality, we are really practicing the same thing, just again, as I keep saying, with different language and culture. Now, all that being said, yes, let me say, any follower of Asatru is welcome in any Vedic temple, in any Hindu temple. Now, of course, the thing is, Hindu temples are all different. You know, they might represent a specific organization or the specific community in what area you're talking about. But let me just say that generally speaking, any Asatru follower is certainly welcome to come to any Vedic temple and to worship with us, etc. And as far as what to expect when entering into such a temple, very simply, of course, when you enter into such a temple, you take your shoes off. Of course, you have to be very reverential. When you enter into any sort of Vedic temple, you tend to be somewhat quiet. If you do speak, it tends to be somewhat in whispers as opposed to very loudly. What you will see will be the statues. We do not call them idols because idol is a pejorative term. We don't like the term idol. What you will see is the sacred iconography, the sacred images of the gods and goddesses. And what I would say is if a person wishes to visit a Hindu temple, please feel free to do so. And again, as long as you're respectful and you take your shoes off, etc., you are more than welcome to come and visit any Vedic or Hindu or Dharmic temple.
So you mentioned about the imagery and the iconography of the gods and goddesses in the Vedic tradition. We do know that there are different sects that kind of interpret divinity a little bit differently in Sanatana Dharma. Can you give us a quick rundown of what your specific sect is and maybe the differences between them?
Sure. Well, I don't really strictly follow a specific sect per se. Rather, what I present is Sanatana Dharma in its legitimate and authentic form. So in Sanatana Dharma, and I should explain this a little bit. This is where it gets to be interesting, because of course we know that in, let's say, all non-Abrahamic religious traditions as they are practiced today, there's of course this interesting debate about polytheism versus monotheism. Mm-hmm. And of course, we know that many individuals who today follow pre-Christian European religion will often call themselves polytheists. For myself, interestingly, I take a strictly Vedic approach, which is that we are both, in a way, polytheists and monotheists. And let me explain what is meant by this. We are polytheists cosmologically. That is, we accept the fact that when we look at the universe around us, there are indeed a myriad of very powerful, beneficent beings. You know, these are the gods and goddesses. And we accept that they all exist and that they are representational, not meaning that they're not real. They are real. They are real personages. They are personalities. But they also do indeed represent various things. So there is a sun god. There is a moon god, et cetera, et cetera. There is an earth goddess and like this. So on the one hand, cosmologically, we do indeed accept the fact that there is a hierarchy of being and that there are powerful beings known as gods and goddesses. But then ultimately, and I truly believe that the vast majority of, again, even pre-Christian European philosophers and theologians also believed this, ultimately there's one absolute that transcends all. You know, Plato wrote about this, even Aristotle, who was not very spiritual, yet he wrote about this, Plotinus, so many people who existed in pre-Christian Europe. So when it comes to Vedic spirituality, we are indeed both. Again, cosmologically, we believe in a multitude of gods, but then as far as ontology, we believe that ultimately there's one supreme being. Now, as far as what that one supreme being is, there is no debate as far as what the scriptures say about this, the Vedic scriptures, that is. And that is that one supreme being is often termed philosophically as Brahman. Brahman simply designating the absolute. Mm. So I wouldn't really talk about Sanatana Dharma in terms of, again, as far as in terms of sects. Sects is a more recent thing. Mm. And the way that I follow Sanatana Dharma is I try to follow it as authentically and legitimately as possible. And that means the way it was practiced literally 5,000 years ago. People have joked with me, actually, and told me that I'm a 5,000-year-old man. Because the way I live and think is the way that people lived and think during the Vedic era 5,000 years ago. And I do not give in to modernity. So I don't accept the idea of sects. There's truth and there's untruth. Beautiful. Somewhat long answer, but I hope that answers the question.
Absolutely. Now, I will say I have read there are arguments that say that monism or mono. Let's start with this. What is the difference between monism and monotheism?
Oh, yes, they are different. The idea of monotheism is the idea that ultimately, as I said earlier, ontologically speaking, there is one transcendent absolute and whatever you wish to call that. Again, you know, there are different things that you can say about that absolute. But as a bare minimum, that ultimately there is one absolute from which all reality emanates. So that's monotheism on the one hand. Monism, on the other hand, is a more, let's say, philosophical versus a theological idea. Monism teaches the idea, and this gets a little bit complicated, but I'll state this as briefly philosophically as I can. Monism is the idea that if you were to examine the nature of ultimate reality, what you would find is that there is no distinction between anything that is of importance. In other words, that we and God are one, that ultimately there is one reality, that is God, and anything outside of the idea of God is simply an illusion and thus really non-existent. That's monism. What in Sanskrit is called Advaita, Advaita. Advaita simply means not two. Dvaita means two, meaning that there is duality, mm-hmm. that there is distinction. Is the negation of that. So Advaita means not two, so monism. And monism is certainly one of the, let's say, more modern ideas of Vedic spirituality. And by modern, I have to explain, I mean modern meaning in the last roughly 1,500 years. But again, monism is not really the philosophical foundation of Sanatana Dharma as found in the scriptures themselves.
So my question before that, and we're going to ask that right now, I have read there are certain people that say that monotheism or monism, you're talking about the absolute oneness, that the concept of oneness or Brahman is due to Abrahamic influence on Eastern culture. What would you say to people that have that theory?
That it's not a real theory. That actually, yeah, this is something that we could talk about for a long time because, again, you know, I actually have a PhD in languages and cultures of Asia, and I know the entire history of how Westerners studied Vedic spirituality, especially early on in the 1700s, 1800s, continuing into the 20th, now 21st century. And especially initially, because many of the Western scholars who began to study what we call Hinduism, because many of these people were Christians, any time that they saw anything that even in the most remote way resembled Christianity, they got excited. And of course would say, well, just see, these people, these savage Hindus stole this from us. Mm-hmm. You know, and again, I've seen this having studied Vedic spirituality for the last 46 years, I've seen this again and again and again. No, the idea of monotheism goes back to Rig Veda. It goes back literally at least 5,000 years. The idea of monism, which again, I'm not a monist, but this is certainly one of the aspects of Vedic spirituality as it's practiced today. The idea of devotion, you know, there's a school called bhakti, which means devotion. Mm-hmm. I literally read very old scholars who wrote in the 19th century who said, oh, look at this bhakti that you have in this Hinduism. They obviously stole this idea of devotion to God from we Christians. And of course, the truth of the matter is you find the concept of bhakti or devotion in Vedic scriptures that go back thousands of years before Christ. Indeed, again, the first time you find the idea of devotion, of bhakti, is in Rig Veda, which is the oldest scripture, not just in Hinduism, but on earth. It's actually the oldest written book on earth that goes back 5,000 years. So yeah, whenever someone tries to say, oh, look, this concept in Vedic spirituality obviously came from the Christians. No, it can be shown these concepts go back thousands of years before Christ even existed.
So back to kind of the commonalities and you mentioned about lineage, and that is a very important concept in Vedic spirituality. And unfortunately, it is a tradition that we have lost. We are beginning to rebuild it. However, it is lost for us. Now, with you specifically, do you have lineage as a spiritual teacher? And if so, who were your teachers? And kind of give us an explanation of lineage for you personally.
Sure, absolutely. Well, for myself, I mean, Well, generally speaking, the way that you enter into a spiritual lineage, into an actual, let's say, school of thought, into one of these spiritual streams that goes back to the very beginning of time, is that you take initiation, what in Sanskrit is called diksha. You take initiation from an authentic guru who likewise was initiated by an authentic guru, and you can trace this back, again, from guru to guru, going back to the beginning of time. And this is one of the mechanisms that assures that what we are doing is indeed something that is authentic, something that's real, not just made up. See, this is one of the things about, again, many modern so-called New Age teachers, including New Age people, is that they have zero lineage. They can't show, well, all right, maybe they had a teacher. Well, who's that person's teacher? Eventually it gets lost, you know, and you usually don't have to go back very far. Whereas with us, when we have an individual who says, oh, I am a guru, that person better be prepared to show who is your guru and who is that person's guru, and stretching back quite literally to the beginning of time. So now all that as just a little preface. Yeah, for myself, I have several spiritual teachers who have taught me personally. The first individual who I took initiation from was Sri Yatiraja Acharya, was his name. He was an individual who I met when I was approximately 14 or 15. It was so long ago, I can't remember exactly, but I know I was either 14 or 15 years old. And I met him in New York. He was the first individual who instructed me and who gave me initiation. And very specifically, he gave me initiation in the primary mantra that I meditate upon, which is Om Namo Narayanaya. That's the mantra that he imparted upon me that I still meditate upon to this day. And in his particular case, he was in what is called the Sri Vaishnava Sampradaya. He was in the Sri Vaishnava lineage. And that is one of the most orthodox, one of the most ancient lineages in the entirety of Sanatana Dharma. In addition to him, I also have several other initiations. And I won't talk about them all because that would take time. But the other also significant one was in 1985 when I went to India for the first time, and I took initiation from another very authentic guru. His name was Bhakti Rakshaka Sridhar Swami, or just Sridhar Swami for short. And he initiated me in what is called the Gaudiya Vaishnava Sampradaya. And again, another lineage that stretches back. And that was the second, let's say, initiation that I took from another guru. He also, a year later, I went back to India again. He also initiated me as what is called a Brahmana, or a Vedic priest. So I am a legitimate, authentic, initiated Vedic priest, what is called a Brahmana. And so again, I can go much deeper, but hopefully that answers the question somewhat. I have several other gurus and people who have revealed things to me as well, but those are the two main ones.
Absolutely. That's a beautiful tradition. But going back to kind of our commonalities, here's something that is a little bit of a difference between our traditions, and I wanted to point this out, and this is something that doesn't exist in Asatru, and that is the practice of asceticism. Could you give us a quick overview of what asceticism is, and why is it spiritually significant in the Vedic tradition?
Sure, definitely. Well, you know, asceticism is a very broad topic, and it's one which, like with so many themes of Vedic spirituality, sadly has been misunderstood in modern times. When people think of asceticism, of course, what they tend to think is of a person, let's say, sitting naked in a cave with no possessions and practically starving to death, et cetera, and their skin and bone. And yeah, that's what people tend to think of, crazy extremes like this. And of course, historically, there have indeed been such people, but that's not the norm. The idea of asceticism is actually not meant to be something that is either harmful or unhealthy to the individual. In fact, on the contrary, it's supposed to be the very opposite of that. It's supposed to be something that is indeed extremely healthy and very beneficial to the person in every way. And the idea essentially is what is expressed in Sanskrit as the word tapas, or austerity, or sometimes asceticism is a good translation of that. It is the idea, very simply, of taking vows, and usually short-term vows. You know, it can be for a week, it can be for a month, for a year, in some cases longer, where you decide purposefully and consciously to go, to undergo a type of very rigorous sort of either training or penance in order to make yourself stronger. That's the legitimate idea of asceticism. Again, it's not something where you harm yourself. It's something where, on the contrary, you are going through a hardship, but you're doing it purposefully, consciously, by choice and by vow, with the idea that you will then achieve something greater. So, for example, you know, as I'm sure you know, for myself, for any legitimate Vedic guru, for any legitimate Vedic teacher, we tend to be very strict in our lifestyle. So thus, for myself, and again, other legitimate Vedic gurus, I'll just give you the whole list. We don't smoke. We don't smoke anything, any sort of substance. We don't take any drugs of any sort whatsoever. We don't drink anything, anything alcoholic. You know, we have sexual fidelity. That is, we believe in monogamy if married. If not married, we believe in celibacy. We don't believe in sleeping around. We don't believe in, you know, we believe in a very strong sense of ethics and virtue. In fact, virtue ethics is actually the official term of what we believe. And I know that there are the nine noble virtues in Asatru. What we follow is something that's very, very similar, except expanded upon. For us, it's not just nine virtues, but it's many, many more than that. But, you know, I'm very familiar with the nine noble virtues, and we would agree with every single one of those. But again, we believe in living what some would consider a pretty strict lifestyle. But what is the purpose? The idea is, again, to bring ourselves to the maximal degree of perfection that we can as imperfect beings. You know, we recognize that we're finite, that we're imperfect beings. But why not strive to be the best? Why not strive to be the best that we can? And again, not the best in an arrogant, you know, conquering sort of way. No, actually with great humility, the idea of self-unfoldment, the idea of self-development in a real way. Again, not a new agey sort of self-improvement sort of idea. But no, in a very ancient idea of, yes, undergoing hardships, doing things that the common person would consider to be difficult vows to take. But we understand that they make us stronger. And this is indeed one thing among many that Vedic people strive for, and that is to be strong in every way, to be courageous, to be individuals who we are like lotuses made of steel. That's our goal. So this is why, again, the lifestyle that especially serious practitioners of Vedic spirituality have, yes, it, for the common person, it would seem to be austerity, even asceticism. But again, for us, we believe in doing this in a very healthy way, a way that will actually help us.
The reason that I asked that question is because since I started doing more work in the spiritual community and getting involved with organizations like the Nirona Society and Arya Akasha and all of these really great organizations, I've had the pleasure of rubbing shoulders with people that practice the living tradition of Vedic spirituality. And the one thing that I noticed that was starkly different was about diet and celebration and stuff like that. They have a deep cultural thing when it comes to drinking and eating and stuff like that. That's something that if you read some of the older, I'm sure you've read Tacitus Germania and some of that stuff. It's very clear that our Germanic ancestors practiced, I guess, what you could call asceticism or discipline in ways of the flesh, such as abstinence and stuff like holding off till you get married and those kinds of things. But as far as diet for us, like, for example, eating meat is sacred. We eat meat for our bloats and stuff like that. We drink mead for our bloats and stuff like that. But that's not really present in Vedic spirituality, is it?
Well, interestingly, to a limited degree, it is among what are called the Kshatriyas. And not even all Kshatriyas. Kshatriyas are the warrior class. Let's say the warrior / political / administrative leader class, let's say, of Vedic spirituality. And even then, not with all of them, this is especially true with the true royalty, is that for example, some of them indeed will be meat eaters and in fact hunters. And indeed, interestingly, the Vedic scriptures give them permission to do so. And the reason why this is the case is because, well, the reason why Vedic royalty hunt is because they're honing their martial skills. Mm-hmm. They're learning how to use that bow and arrow. They're learning how to use that spear. They're learning how to go deep into the forest and to hunt prey fearlessly, thus preparing themselves for their task ahead, which is, again, to be warriors. So in some limited cases, indeed, it is fine to eat meat. And this is the other thing also. It is very important to understand the difference between, let's say, lay individuals who are practicing a specific religion versus individuals who are completely dedicated to making spiritual advancement as, again, ascetics or yogis or priests or individuals who this is their full-time commitment, is to simply practice spirituality. So, for example, people have pointed this out to me. People have said, oh, well, wait a minute. I know a Hindu family, and they all eat meat, and yet they call themselves Hindu. Well, yeah, those are lay people. They can do whatever they want. Mm-hmm. The common individual who says, oh, I am a follower of Sanatana Dharma, but I'm just a pretty normal person. Yeah, they do not necessarily need to follow strict vows. But on the other hand, if a person wishes to not be a spiritual practitioner simply in name alone, that is just nominally, but they wish to actually practice spirituality in a serious way, those are the individuals who then begin to lead a more ascetic lifestyle. So thus, we've seen throughout the history of Europe, actually, we've seen in ancient Europe that there are many, for example, pagan traditions where, yes, people who are serious spiritual practitioners, they do become vegetarian. You know, we know that Plato talked about this, for example. You know, many of these individuals who, again, they weren't just nominal pagans, but no, these were people who they wanted to truly dedicate themselves wholly and completely to spirituality. Many of these people ended up becoming more ascetic. You know, Pythagoras is famous for this, for example. He and his followers were all strict vegetarians, and they didn't drink alcohol, et cetera, et cetera. So again, there's that distinction between the majority of followers of a spiritual tradition versus those, let's say, lone individuals who truly, truly dedicate themselves to full spiritual unfoldment.
So, you mentioned something earlier. You said you reject New Ageism, which anybody who watches the blog knows that I rip New Ageism every chance I get. And your video, when you talked about New Ageism and you said this is going to be my philosophical attack, essentially, of New Ageism, you ripped it apart. And that was one of my favorite videos that you did. And you even go back, talk about Aleister Crowley and a lot of these weirdos and stuff like that. But, where's my question? This was one that Tristan gave to me. We run into this problem with New Agers in our spirituality, and also true, that try to chalk up divinity like it's just, you know, I guess a natural phenomenon, or it's, they say that they're archetypes or something like that. And his question for you was, when discussing religion, are we to understand the gods as actual, immanent, and personable deities, or are these metaphors or natural phenomena or subconscious processes?
Mm. Yeah, that is a good question. That's definitely, yeah, very common, not just question, but debate that, of course, has been going on for actually many decades. Even though technically it goes back a little bit before Jung, really it was Carl Gustav Jung who really is the individual most responsible for this idea of archetypes and the idea that, yes, the gods simply represent, let's say, psychological phenomena that exist within the psyche of the individual and that they aren't actually real beings. So this is an idea that goes back some time. And let me just say, actually, just as an aside, I've studied Jung quite deeply. I was never impressed by Jung. He's an individual who was a speculator who was, his claim for fame is that he was slightly better than Freud. So people who take Jung too seriously really have to stop doing this. Jung was he was a genius, but he was wrong on almost every count, unfortunately. He was a semi-atheist. He knew nothing about spiritual experience, let's just say. Yep. a vivid, rich, living, spiritual experience. He was just an idle speculator. But yes, this idea really, one could say, goes back to him. And let me just say this. This is also, like you, something I'm very, very blunt and strict about. The gods, the goddesses, all of these nature beings are as real as you and I. They are personalities. They are persons. They have their own will. They have their own personalities. They have their own likes and dislikes. They have their own freedom to do as they wish. These are beings who are as, again, real as our own mother, our own father, as our best friend, and as us. And again, this idea, this very silly idea that these simply represent, oh, and people say different things. Oh, they represent simply energetic elements of nature. They represent, again, phenomena that exist within the psyche of human beings. They represent simply archetypes, their ideas, they're symbolic, et cetera, et cetera. No. They are no more symbolic as is our mother. Our own mother, our own father. These are real beings. And more, if we are going to claim that we are spiritual individuals, we have to understand what the word spiritual means. It means that we are dealing with the spirit. It means that we are dealing with beings who, again, they are spirit. They are personalities as we are. And if we are going to approach these beings in a symbolic form, we are both cheating ourselves because we are not entering into true relationship with these beings. And that's where spirituality lies. That's where the heart of spirituality lies. You know, what is spirituality? It's talking about, generally speaking, so many beings, whether it's Thor or Odin, whether it's Krishna or Shiva, whether it's so many beings. And the idea of these beings being hierarchically vastly superior to us and thus having the ability to benefit us as a result of their company. That's spirituality in a nutshell. Well, what does it mean when we claim to be spiritual people, yet rather than entering into true and beneficial relationship with these higher beings, we say, oh, these beings don't really exist. And the very idea of these beings in either symbolic or archetypal form, that these very ideas of these beings exist simply to serve us in our egotistical attempt to gain power in this world. See, that is New Age and really Luciferian spirituality versus true spirituality. In a nutshell, Luciferian and New Age spirituality, which in a way is the same thing, is a matter of using spirituality for selfish purposes, using the gods the way I've expressed it in the past in my lectures. You're using the gods as a hammer, as a tool, as an inanimate object for your use, selfishly and narcissistically. There's that versus real spirituality. And in real spirituality, you do not use the gods. Rather, you serve the gods. Rather, you have humility before the gods. You honor the gods. You understand that, no, these gods, when it comes to the let's say, ontologically, the hierarchy of being, of qualitative being, these gods are so vastly above us and yet linked to us. And that being the case, the relationship that we can have with them, if done, again, with humility and devotionally, can be so beneficial to us that it will change our lives for the better. So we're missing out on all that when we say, oh, these gods are just symbols. Oh, they're just archetypes. Oh, they just represent some psychological phenomena that's there and hidden within the dark recesses of the id. And we start to try to become Freudian or Jungian in our understanding of the gods and goddesses. Yeah, we're missing out, and more, we're insulting these beings.
Yeah.
Imagine going up to our mother and saying, oh, mom, you've been a good symbol of something.
Yeah.
Imagine treating our mother like a tool, like a hammer, like a thing, like a that instead of a thou. You know, treating our own mother like a tool that we're just using for our own benefit rather than a person. We're insulting our own mother. Well, the gods and goddesses are like mothers and fathers, like grandmothers, grandfathers to us. And every time that we that we negate their personhood, we're just insulting them. Better to not even pretend to be spiritual. Just be an atheist. Go join a Marxist organization. Go join Antifa. Go, go be an atheist. Just don't play with spirituality. Don't pretend you're spiritual, and yet you are denying the spirit. You're denying the personality.
Yeah. I don't know how this came about. These people that came up with these theories must have never read the Eddas. You mentioned about how they are the gods are like our grandfather. Well, in also true, we literally believe that, and we understand that to be true. In one of our texts, the Rig's Thula, it describes clearly that the gods come down and create the castes of men. In Voluspa, it says that Odin comes with his two brothers, Honor and Lothor, to give man his features. The first men ask an embla, which I believe Indo-Europeans understand to be manus, and I'm not familiar with the other stuff, but it's clear as day in our text. I have no idea how anybody got the idea that it was good to skip over all of that and just start making stuff up, or leaning on atheists that were around 60 years ago that came up with these theories. It's blasphemous. I would say that. I would say it's blasphemous.
There's another saying that I'm apparently famous for now, only in the Kali Yuga.
Yeah, only in the Kali Yuga. That's right.
This is one of many modern phenomena that is reflective of the very worst of modernity, where, you see, this is the sad hypocrisy of it all, that on the one hand, you have so many individuals who, of course, they will claim that, oh, they're trying to follow something ancient, and yet they take ideas that represent the very worst of modernity and try to artificially graft that upon the ancient.
Yeah.
And it doesn't work. And it leads to confusion on everyone's part. And more, it leads to going nowhere spiritually on the part of individuals who attempt to do that.
So, one saying that we run into a lot in Asa Drew, thankfully, a lot of these kind of ideas are starting to go out the door, because there's guys like me and Neurona Society and many of our brothers and sisters that are of devotional, authentic faith that are telling them that they're not welcome anymore. We don't want to hear this stuff. But one argument that we hear a lot is we say, well, are you a believer in the gods? And they'll say, what do you mean believe in the gods? I am the gods, or I am a god, or I strive to be a god. And it's offensive. It really is. It makes somebody that's devotional very angry. Those of us that run into this kind of stuff and we get frustrated by these kinds of people, how would you suggest that we deal with them or deal with these situations?
First of all, it's to understand what is the origin of this, and the origin is Aleister Crowley. You know, this idea that we are the gods, of course, now we also, in the last several decades, have seen this in, again, the New Age movement as well. Where rather than worshiping, for example, with a lot of so-called spiritual feminists, rather than worshiping goddesses, they will all claim, oh, I am the goddess. Am the goddess. You must treat me as a goddess, et cetera, et cetera. I am manifesting the goddess in my life. I am becoming the god, et cetera, et cetera. It's all self-centered, narcissistic nonsense. And really, the way that we trace this back is it ultimately does indeed go back to Aleister Crowley, who had the idea that the goal of life was indeed, and this is a very quick summary, you know, this is not doing full, let's say, full justice to his ideas, but it's accurate nonetheless. He had this idea that we are all indeed meant to become stars in the heavens, that we are all meant to become gods and goddesses, and that we are indeed gods and goddesses, you know, we just don't know it. So this, whenever you have an individual who is making such a statement, whether in Asa True, whether there are some people who will say this in Vedic spirituality today as well. And it's horrific when I hear this. Ultimately, either directly or indirectly, this idea can be traced back to a degenerate Luciferian nut job, Aleister Crowley.
Yes.
He was the person who first introduced this idea into certainly Western occultism, in the modern era, into what later became Wicca. He's also really the, one could say through Gardner, he was the individual who really was one of the ideological foundations of Wicca, but now New Ageism as well.
Scientology?
So, I'm sorry?
Scientology as well?
Scientology as well, something I always have to point out to people that people aren't even aware. Yes, L. Ron Hubbard, the person who founded Scientology, was indeed a follower of Aleister Crowley. He was a Luciferian Satanist. Thus, Scientology is a religion that is based upon Luciferianism. You know, L. Ron Hubbard, along with Jack Parsons, famous, one of the founders of jet propulsion in America, they were both Luciferians. They did Luciferian demonic rituals in the deserts of, I believe, the Mojave Desert. And yes, L. Ron Hubbard was the founder of Scientology, and he was a follower of Aleister Crowley. So much of this goes back to Aleister Crowley. It is amazing, and it's always sickening when I see individuals who they claim that they're following a more authentic form of spirituality, whether Asatru, and like you, I've seen this also. I'll see individuals, oh, I'm a follower of Asatru, I'm wearing a Thor's hammer, and yet they'll have symbols of Thelema, which is the Crowleyan religion,
yeah. You
know, in addition to Thor's hammers, etc. Whether it's in Asatru, Hellenismos, whether it's in Celtic spirituality, whether it's in Vedic spirituality, you will find modern individuals today who claim that they're following these authentic forms of spirituality, yet half the ideas and a fourth of the practices that they have can be traced back to Aleister Crowley. Thus, they're very confused. And in some cases, they're aware of that. In many cases, they're not. And that's even sadder. That's even sadder. But yes, what you said earlier is indeed something that now has to be done unapologetically with all of the, again, now, let's say, authentic forms of ancient spirituality. Asatru, I am doing this in Vedic spirituality, and that is, we must expel these frauds unapologetically. Unapologetically. If a person claims that they're following an ancient and authentic form of spirituality, yet they're Satanists, yet they're mixing it with New Age garbage and et cetera, et cetera. No, these people have to be, first of all, educated. We have to make the attempt to educate them, which is what I spend half my time doing, is just trying to educate these people that no, this idea that you think you have, this is where it goes back to. It doesn't go back to the Vedas. It's 50 years old, 30 years old. We need to first educate these people. And for the ones who are truly insincere and they know that they're wrong, but they don't care, yes, we need to just expose these people and just leave them in the dust.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of folks, they don't quite understand how nefarious a lot of these ideologies are and how nefarious the individuals are who push these ideologies and infiltrate and subvert our true ancient traditions. And what I'd like to point out is a lot of these organizations, you know, we're talking Thelema, Temple of Set. I'm not going to name all of them because I don't want to give them airtime. But a lot of these organizations are indeed involved with child trafficking, are involved with these really bizarre, grotesque, disgusting rituals where they hurt kids and innocent people. This is real life. This is real stuff. And a lot of folks don't, they're like, oh, well, it sounds ridiculous. And you bring up the evidence and show them. These are the kind of people that are trying to infiltrate our authentic spiritual paths and teach our people these kinds of disgusting perversions of religion. So I'm with you 100%. It's really disgusting.
Can I say two very quick things about what you just said that are absolutely crucial? And first of all, I'm so happy that both yourself, but I see so many people finally recognizing this. But two very quick things. First of all, when it comes to this sector of demonic people who are demonic people in the name of spirituality, and let me just list them. Luciferians, Satanists, so-called left-hand practitioners.
Yes.
Number one, let me make this clear. Whenever we hear these terms in the future, whenever we hear some person on Facebook, on YouTube, somewhere in social media say, oh, I am such and such, but I'm also Luciferian, or I'm doing left-hand path, blah, 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 that's synonymous with pedophile. Number one, we have to recognize that once and for all. If a person claims that they are a Luciferian, that's synonymous with saying they are a pedophile, because you are correct. These are pedophile movements, and we have to recognize them as such. We have to shame them as such, and we have to have them locked away and at the very least shunned, because these are individuals who do indeed hurt children. They hurt animals. These are demonic people who cause nothing but pain in this world. That's the first thing. Second thing is, yes, you pointed this out very, very wisely. These people, since Aleister Crowley, actually, have had a concerted campaign for, again, 100 years of infiltrating legitimate and authentic spirituality and spiritual traditions and movements. And they have done this in some cases very successfully, in some cases somewhat successfully to varying degrees. But yes, these people do this on purpose. It is part of their modus operandi. It is part of their strategy. Wherever they see purity, these individuals purposefully go into those areas. They've done this with recently. They've tried to do this with even Vedic spirituality, where suddenly you'll see this pop up. Oh, I'm a follower of Sanatana Dharma, but a left-hand path follower, i.e. a pedophile Satanist. They've done this with Asatru. They've done this with so many different traditions. For that matter, they've even done this with the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
And of course, we're not Abrahamists, so we care about that a little bit less. But it's amazing. They began infiltrating the Catholic Church starting in the 30s, when Aleister Crowley was still alive. And very successfully so, let me say. Yeah. More successful. If people knew how successfully these Luciferians have taken over the Catholic Church, these pedophiles, they would be shocked. They would be shocked. A little bit, of course, of it comes out in the news once in a while with pedophile priests, but it's worse than people imagine. Pedophilia is their religion, these Luciferians. So yes, indeed, we need to always be aware that these people have infiltrated anything good that they see, and quite successfully so. Well, now these people have to be put on the run. And that's been one of my goals. I'm sure it's one of yours as well.
Yes.
These people have to be exposed, and they have to be put on the run and thrown out of every legitimate spiritual tradition on earth. And all of these legitimate, authentic spiritual traditions have to be restored to their purity. And thus, a golden age will come about.
Absolutely. That's music to my ears. I couldn't agree with you more, man. That's something that really gets me fired up, and I've been fighting with these people, trying to expose these people for years, and I'm so thankful, and we are so blessed in our tradition that folks are actually starting to awaken to it, and they're starting to see it, because unfortunately, we don't have, as we talked about earlier, and also true, we don't have the lineage, we don't have the fortifying effects of these established traditions and stuff like that, so it's very easy for them to slither in and pervert and subvert, and thankfully, we're chasing them out, and very soon, they will be out completely. We're going to bog them. Well, anyway, we are coming up on the end of the hour, so I don't want to keep you too long, but you did have something. We're going to end on a very, very positive note. You have something that you wanted to share with my audience, as well as the Asatru community as a whole.
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely. And actually, can you tell me approximately how long do we have, just so I know how to...
We are up on an hour, but you can take as long as you take. We were talking about such good things that I wanted to keep going. So if take as long as you need.
All right. Well, this should take no more than maybe 5 minutes or so. But yes, this is something that I'm going to be revealing exclusively on your show for the first time in 6 years or so since this first came about, and that is this: that interestingly, several years ago, I'm not going to name names or anything like this, but I had several years ago, approximately 2014 or so, several individuals who were Asatru leaders approach me and speak to me on a wide variety of topics, including assistance, help that they wanted in essentially restoring, let's say, traditional and authentic spiritual practices, what in Sanskrit would be called sadhana, that is the actual yogic techniques for growing spiritually, which again, while certainly there are indeed such techniques within Asatru even to this day, still they felt that they needed something a little bit deeper. And when they asked me this, my response was soon thereafter to go and sit in front of our altar here at our temple. You can't see now, but to my left, we have a beautiful, beautiful altar that is here. I sat in front of this altar and I went very deeply into meditation, and very specifically asking that Thor would be revealed to me. Thor, very specifically. Jayanta in Sanskrit. Thor is known in Sanskrit as Jayanta. But when I did this, very interestingly, two mantras were revealed to me in meditation, in Sanskrit, in the actual wow. Sanskrit language. And when that happened, immediately I opened my eyes. I offered what is called offered my obeisances. That is, I laid my head down before the altar in thanks, and I very quickly wrote them down. And these are two Thor mantras that are in Sanskrit that, again, I have had possession of for the last 6 years. I have initiated a tiny number of people in Asatru, people who follow Asatru very, very strictly. I've initiated a tiny number of individuals in these mantras. I have otherwise kept them secret. And these other individuals have, while teaching these mantras, they've done so very quietly, very secretly. So this is really going to be the very first time that I would like to, on your show, reveal these mantras to the world that were revealed to me in 2014. And as I mentioned earlier, I'll also send these to you so that you will have possession of the actual spelling and everything of these mantras, and you can please feel free to, you know, publicize these in whatever way you can. But there are two mantras. One is a simple Thor mantra, a mantra to Thor. The other, the second, is a Thor Gayatri mantra. And what a Gayatri mantra is, you know, there are different mantras known as Gayatri mantras. And these are mantras that basically are revealed in the Rig Veda and other places. I don't want to go very deeply into the distinction, but Gayatri mantras are considered to be the most sacred of mantras. And I would like to reveal these mantras to you and to your audience now for the very first time ever publicly. So with your permission, the Thor mantra that was revealed to me, and this is a mantra to Thor, is very simply, Om Odin Putraya Namaha. Om Odin Putraya Namaha. That's the first mantra, which is a mantra to Thor. And I'll give you the translation as well. What the mantra is saying is, I offer my obeisances, or I offer my respects, to the son of Odin. So thus designating Thor. Now the second one is a little bit longer. And this is what is called Thor Gayatri mantra. It's called Gayatri because it has a certain meter in which you recite this. So again, this is a little bit longer, and maybe I'll even say it a little bit slower just so that people can hear properly. Om Odin Putraya Vidmahe Vajrahastaya Dhimahi Tanno Donar Prachodayat. Let me recite this just one more time before I give the translation. Om Odin Putraya Vidmahe Vajrahastaya Dhimahi Tanno Donar Prachodayat. And let me give the translation of this Thor Gayatri. Om, let us meditate upon the son of Odin. May Thor, that great wielder of the thunderbolt, inspire and illumine our minds and understanding. So this is the Thor Gayatri Mantra. So these are, again, two mantras that were revealed to me. I purposefully have kept them in safekeeping for the last 6 years. Again, other than initiating a tiny number of people, several leaders of Asatru in these mantras, and they themselves very quietly, I believe, have initiated several other people. These mantras have never been uttered publicly. And the reason why I'm revealing these to your audience today is as a gift, as a very, very humble gift. As a guru, as an acharya, as a preceptor and leader of the Vedic tradition, I wish to give this as a very humble gift to the followers of Asatru as two legitimate Sanskrit mantras in which we can invoke the very spirit of Thor, which we need today very, very much in our struggles ahead. So thank you for giving me this opportunity.
Absolutely. We are so grateful to, man, that is, what a special, special gift. And everybody in the chat, man, many hails to the Acharya. What a beautiful, wonderful gift he has given us. And unfortunately, sir, we are running out of time. We are at the end. This was absolutely incredible interview. This is probably my favorite interview I've ever done, I'll be honest with you. And I just want to reiterate what a treasure you are to us in the Asatru community. And we cherish your teachings and your friendship forever. Thank you so much, Acharya.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you again very much for having me on. And may everyone have the blessings of the gods for the times ahead. Wow. Namaste.
Namaste. Hail.